This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport, powered by fans.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery, just like Leicester City this season. So the only thing left to say is, you in? Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too. So that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants, 18 plus. Rewards registration required, points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
95% of Uber Eats orders are on time, which is great. Because when I want my spicy shrimp pad Thai, I want it on time. Because baby, there's no time like the present. Especially when it's pad Thai related. But on the off chance your order is late, Uber Eats will give you 3 months, $0 delivery fee with a free Uber One membership. On time, pad Thai, baby.
On time claim based on latest arrival time shown after order is placed. Offer ends 2/19/2023. Current Uber One members not eligible. Subscription will auto renew at $9.99 each month, starting 3 months from initial enrollment. See uber.com/uber1 for terms. Benefits available only for eligible stores. Order minimums apply.
Strap yourself in,
because we're set up, switched on, and ready to go.
You are watching and listening to Chris and Leicester Till I Die TV on YouTube
and your favorite podcasts.
Till I Die TV, your first choice for everything Leicester City.
Tune in
and join in now.
And now, here's your host.
All right, Chris.
All right there. Good evening, everybody. How the devil are we? Well, I hope. And looking forward to the new season. We are getting closer and closer. It's a few days away now. Wondering what will come first. The first game or our first signing. Yeah, it's going to be the first game, isn't it? Let's be honest. But we've got a special tonight. As you can see there, it says along the bottom, we're doing an in-conversation with and one of my favourite managers at Leicester City, Brian Little. We'll bring him in. Just got to quickly say that if you are watching this for the first time and you've just found the channel, please press the subscribe button and give us a follow. It would be much appreciated, and smash those likes as well. Okay, well, let us bring the gentleman himself in and say good morning to Brian. Good morning, hi, Brian.
How are you? All right. I'm good. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much. Very well. Thanks so much for coming on. You are still thought of as the manager that really started the whole Leicester City revival off. I mean, I know it was, you know, it's been roller coaster up and down since then, but you know, up until that point of you joining us, we really, really were stagnating.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it was, you know, I'd had a couple of brilliant years at Darlington, and throughout that time, you know, one or two people had approached my chairman about potentially moving on, and he always said, look, can we just get through the season and see how we were? And I was enjoying it. You know, it was my first job, and it was, and I was really into it. And it was a level that I'd got used to. It was back home for me as well, which was quite important. But the day Leicester City got in touch, I got a phone call off my chairman, which was a brilliant call, and said, look, I think I've had the call that you need. And within a day, I was, you know, down in the Midlands and signing the deal. So it was a very whirlwind situation. And it was the sort of club that I couldn't say, I mean, obviously I haven't played there quite some times, You just got a feeling that at last there was the opportunity for me to sort of try and stamp my authority on football, which is what I wanted to do. You know, I mean, I had football taken away from me when I was 26 year old. You know, I was injured and you know, lots of people, because I've been in football for years, forget that I was, you know, really young when I had to retire from the game. So I worked hard, you know, and I had to change my image. I mean, I was a long-haired, scruffy little so-and-so when I played football.
I've seen the videos.
Yeah. So I had to really have a look at myself, look in the mirror, to have a good chat to myself, try and create this sort of, what was me, actually. I mean, it really was me. People just thought, because of the way I looked, I was not interested in the coaching side of football or anything. But I'd worked hard to on myself and studied the game and worked with some good people. Bruce Rioch was brilliant for me at Middlesbrough when I worked with him. So there was lots of things, and I felt I was ready for the Leicester job. I mean, I think when I first came, one or two people went, you know, are you going to be able to go to this level from where you've been at? And I was confident enough to say, yeah, I think I know what I'm doing now. I'm ready for this. And I was really, really buzzing and really looking forward to it.
I mean, just to take you back then to what you were saying about having to retire, that was obviously through an injury. And to be honest with you, that was the 70s. So you were allowed to have long hair.
Well, of course, I mean, you know, in the terms of some of the players that played for Leicester, the Frank Worthingtons and all these sort of lads in the past, when Birch had long hair and all that sort of stuff, you know, it was the way we were, you know, and we were just very ordinary, everyday footballers who went to the pub and had a pint with the fans after the games and things like that. You know, there's a massive transition in football. You know, young people today wouldn't understand how football was in the 70s.
Oh, it
was completely different. I mean, it was still very, well, ultra competitive, let me tell you that, but there was a different way about it, you know, and lifestyles weren't as they are today. And you really were very connected with your fans. As a football player back in the 70s. So once that was taken away from me, you know, that was a big chunk of my life disappeared. And I mean, I often sit here now today looking back and think, wow, how have I stayed in this game for 50 years? I've been unbelievably lucky. I've worked hard, you know, I've worked hard at it. But I've had to work hard to get on. But the transition from the football player to the football coach manager was one that I worked very hard at.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, I a good friend of the channel is Elton Wellesby, who used to present The Big Match on ITV. He's been on quite a few times talking about Everton. And when you see ITV4 and the show The Big Match Revisited, and you look, I mean, if that was transferred to today's game, you'd end up with, well, probably not even a five-a-side football team on each side. I mean, it was, the tackles went in, but how you played on those pitches, I do not know.
you look back now, and that's the outstanding feature of the game itself and the skill of some of the players that they showed in those days. You know, the way that they somehow keep the ball off the ground, flick it over the head and do little things. I mean, it was completely different. I mean, I take my hat off to the modern day footballer. I think they're unbelievable athletes now. You know, they're really fit and they're strong and their body mass and everything is absolutely perfect. Their skill levels are really high. So, you know, you can't take that away. I just look back and enjoy the period I played in. It was very tough. You know, I've still got the scars to prove that, and one or two stories which I can't tell you right now. But they were tough. Some of the lads, I mean, you know, you walked on the pitch and you just looked to see who was centre half that day, and you thought, oh, I'm going to get some hammer today. But it was just part of it, and we loved it, and still to this day, I still enjoy the nostalgia of looking back. Sometimes, some days I spend a day just going back through those sort of programmes that you talk about. And it's just refreshing, and it's just good to see. But I've moved very much into this modern game. I've had to, because I've stayed in the game. And I love the game as it is today as well. I think the fan base is incredible. The coverage is incredible. And, you know, it's great to be able to watch any game you want from most parts of the world. And that in itself is enjoyable.
It's a completely different game now. And, you know, fans complain, but the, shall we say, more mature football fans like myself, we, you know, we do look back on those times and think, like, you know, the pens behind the foot, behind the goals, and oh, it used to block the flare. But I remember saying how different it was. Steve Linex, the ex-Leicester player, and he was telling me that during the pre-match talk by Jock Wallace, Mark Wallington, our goalkeeper, used to sit on the toilet with the door open, smoking a fag. We don't recommend that, by the way.
But the
good old days, it's good to look back and think, But you like you say, you retired at 26. I think you're going for a move from Villa to Birmingham, weren't you?
When they I nearly made the move across. Yeah. Unfortunately, I failed my medical at the time, which again was one of the things that highlighted some of the problems that I had. Trevor Francis was sold as the first £1 million footballer. Yeah. And Birmingham tried to buy me, which would have been £650,000, which would have been the second highest transfer of its type in that era. And obviously, I had a few issues with Mr. Saunders, who was an incredible manager, but he and I crossed swords quite a few times. Respected him tremendously, great manager, but you know there was just issues for people like myself. Gary Shaw, Tony Morley, he was really tough on us type of players, and you know I would answer back, unfortunately, so I was always like in trouble with him, and he just said to me that day, came in and said, right, you know, I've had an offer off Birmingham City, I want you to go and talk to them, which I did do. Everything was signed, but I failed my medical on a back issue, which again, I've had spinal problems over the last few years. I had major surgery on my back as when I left Leicester City. I had what was called a spondylolisthesis, which was a slight displacement of the vertebrae. So I ended up having an operation in Leicester just before I left, to remove a disc and to fuse my spine up again. So I've been in the wars a little bit, you know, when it comes to football. But moving to Birmingham, it failed. It fell through. But again, you look back into the 70s, our European Cup captain at Aston Villa, Dennis Mortimer, went to Birmingham City. Des Bremner, who won the European Cup with Aston Villa, went to Birmingham City, played more games for Birmingham than he did for Aston Villa. Tony Morley went to Birmingham City on loan. I mean, it's never ending, you know, the little cycle of that era.
And there were a top division club a lot of the time.
But what I'm trying to say is, you know, back in the 70s again, you know, people just moved around in the local area. When somebody went from London to the northeast, everyone was going, what's he doing that for? So, you know, he can't do that. And we didn't, you know, so it was, again, the younger fan doesn't quite understand that. The fans of the time, it was just one of those things. But I failed my medical. The fact that I failed my medical and was offered a lot more money by Birmingham City, as soon as I had a little word in one or two of the lads' ears, they were all knocking on Mr. Saunders' door to get a rise.
You were popular then.
I came back a bit of a hero for the lads because we all got new contracts. So it was just it was one of those issues that, as I've said, in those days it happened. I think today, in the way the context of the world is, or the game is, you know, with social media and all these things, it's more difficult to move to your local rivals for a player. You know, for your family, for your lifestyle and everything that goes on, it is more difficult to do. And it's becoming, well, it doesn't happen so often now that someone goes to a local rivals. I mean, it does happen still. But, you know, as I've said, we used to go down the local pub and things like that, you know. So you were right in amongst your fans. You were closer to them than they are now. You're quite distant for them. But you get a lot of criticism, which can affect your family life and all sorts of things in this modern era. Whereas back in the day, you know, it was just one of those things. I mean, I went to Birmingham. I failed my medical. I came back. I went back and played in the first team. And everybody was happy because they all got a rise. So it wasn't a bad thing, sort of thing.
And probably was a good thing. There was no social media back in them days, absolutely. So you could get away with having a few drinks in the pub.
Well, no, we were allowed. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, team bonding was very much a part of, you know, on a Tuesday, in my playing days at Aston Villa, on a Tuesday, we always trained in the Birmingham, at Birmingham University. And we're encouraged as a group to go up to town afterwards and have a few beers together for this team bonding. You know, I mean, that's just the way it was. You know, I mean, it was back in an era where, you know, pre-match meals, you know, you could eat what you wanted, basically. I mean, it was a case of, for someone like myself, when I was very young in the first team, you know, we used to have like a piece of steak before you play. Highly not recommended in these days. So there's just so many things. Scientifically, the game has moved on. The way the TV side of the game, it's moved on. Everything, the connection, the game is still, I mean, the rules are still there. The players will always be developed from here, there and everywhere. But it's scientifically miles ahead of what it was back in the 70s.
And your first managerial job was Wolverhampton Wanderers.
Yeah.
That probably wasn't the best start.
Well, I was thrown into it. The club was in administration anyway. They couldn't afford to keep people. We used to get, I mean, again, I only worked there for a short period. I think I did 5, 6 or 7 games. I can't remember, but I won 3 of them, lost a couple of them and probably drew 2. And everybody was thinking that I was going to get a chance there. But as it turned out, there was a new consortium coming in, and the first person called in was me. And I was told there and then that you're not the manager we're looking for. They offered me some compensation and I told them where to stick it. I mean, like a fool, I just, I went home and I remember my now ex-wife said to me, well, are you got compensation? I said, well, I've told them to stick it where the sun doesn't shine, sort of thing.
you can't
do that. I said, well, it's too late now. I've told them. So I just walked out. But again, within weeks, Bruce Rioch rang me from Middlesbrough and, I went up to Middlesbrough, became the youth coach for 3 years and was schooled about football management by Bruce Rioch, who took Middlesbrough from the third division to the second division to the first division. It was an incredible period. I loved the way he worked. I loved the way he connected with his players. And he taught me an unbelievable amount. I worked with Bruce, Colin Todd and myself, and then David Nish came in as well. So it was a good combination of people.
Yes.
And later on, obviously, David joined me at Leicester. I was schooled A by the disappointment of having a job and losing it when I was doing okay, but I wasn't ready for it. But I was schooled by Bruce Rioch and 3 years of being close to the first team. Even though I was the youth and reserve team coach at the time, I was always involved in what the work they did. And I worked at a club that went from, you know, again, they'd just come out of administration. And Bruce took them to the first division in the 2 or 3 seasons. And I was part of that group and I enjoyed it and I learned an awful lot. And he genuinely, along with Ron Saunders, who at that time I was beginning to realise how much he actually taught me. Those were the two people that influenced me in terms of football management and how to work, how to get in amongst the players, how to organise a team, how to do training sessions. And all those things were really coming into place. And my 3 years at Middlesbrough after the disappointment of being sacked were vital for me. And that led me on to the job at Darlington, which, again, you know, I've mentioned was really good for me.
I always think Bruce Rioch was a bit of an underrated manager, to be honest with you. I don't always think he got sort of the credit he deserved. I mean, what he could have done maybe at Arsenal had he stayed, you know, they kept him a bit longer, who knows. But no, like you say, a great...
He just signed Bergkamp, hadn't he? I mean, he did bring Bergkamp to the club and that was a massive coup for them. Yeah, I think Bruce was... I've spoken to people and I think he's quite a tough character, quite organised, quite disciplined. And if you look at, Wenger did an incredible job afterwards, but... Yeah. Perhaps his personality was a little less or a little more easy to take. Bruce was very, very sort of thorough, but very hard sometimes. Whereas you look at Wenger, he just seemed incredibly intelligent and had a way of getting through to people. But yeah, I think Bruce would have done well. But he definitely laid some platform there for Mr. Wenger to take over for him.
And then, you know, you say he moved to Darlington and had an amazing successful period there as manager.
Yeah, it was, you know, I got offered the job, I think it was the end of February, and they were bottom of the old fourth division then. And there was pretty much zero chance of keeping them up. But I didn't keep them up as it turned out. But the game before we were relegated, which was the last game of the season, the old chairman resigned. I don't think he wanted to carry the can for getting relegated. And a fellow called Richard Corden, who was on the board, was given the job. And his first game in charge was the day, as a chairman, was the day Darlington were relegated at Scunthorpe. And I was the manager at the time, without a contract, of course. I got a message saying, the chairman wants to see you on the pitch now. And I thought, oh, that's it. That's the end. I'm finished. We're relegated and I'm finished. But he looked at me and went, right, Brian, if you go today, I'm going with you. I said, well, you can't go. You've just got the job as the chairman. He said, no, seriously, if you go, I'm going. I said, well, what's your plan then? He said, well, you've got 2 years. You've got 2 years to get us up. If we're not back in 2 years, we're going to be stuck in non-league football forever, sort of thing. So we shook hands, just said, and we both said, yeah, it wasn't about money. It wasn't about anything. It was about me having a job. So within a week, there was 24 players at the club. 20 of them were out of contract. I just released the 20 players. And went on a mission to try and find a team, which somehow we did. Won the GM Vauxhall Conference, as it was in that period. The year later, we won the old fourth division. And it was the most incredible period, really. I loved it. They were great people. I pop back to Darlington every now and again now, since their demise again. They've got a lovely new stadium. They're in a difficult league, and I'd love to see them get back into the Football League. I think it's not beyond them. But my time at Darlington was wonderful. I had some really good players at that level. And obviously one or two of them followed me to Leicester. You know, I brought one or two, and people were going, well, boy, that level's not as good as what they're looking for. And in some respects, some of the players probably weren't that brilliant, but they had they were great team players, and I built... Yeah. At Leicester, I tried to build a team. It wasn't about individuals at that period. It wasn't about having great players. It was about building a team and team spirit, which I think we did. But certainly I did that at Darlington, without a doubt.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, Leicester came knocking. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the old Filbert Street, it didn't actually inspire you people, did it? It was like... especially the far side as you walked out, the shed side. But I can say, what was it that really sort of appealed to you about Leicester? And obviously, they were a couple of divisions higher, but we'd only just avoided relegation. You know,
yeah,
you
I think...
down to the third tier that time.
Well, I think it was the fact that, you know, I'd played against Leicester many times, and I knew what the crowd was like, and I knew what the support was like, and I knew that the city was a real sporting city, you know, with the cricket in there, the rugby in there, the football in there. So when you... what some people don't realise is, you know, when you're not part of that and you go into places, you realise, you know, you go to Leicester, as I did as an Aston Villa player, and you know you're going into a real sporty area. You know you're going into fans who can be really good. And the night games there, you know, I always remember, you know, going there and playing on a night and thinking, wow, this is... Especially the midweek night games, I thought they were incredible. You know, the fact. So there was a no-brainer for me. You know, I'd done 2 years at Darlington. The Leicester job just appealed to me. And I remember Martin George rang me. And he said, I'll be there in a couple of hours. I said, well, you've got no chance. The motorway from Blumenthal Leicester up there, it's chock-a-block. You've got no chance. And he said, no, I'm going to fly up. And I thought, oh, crikey. And he come up in his own helicopter, didn't he, really? I was thinking, crikey, I'm moving back into a different world here. But Martin and I had a good chat. We got on very well, in fairness. I don't know where he pulled my name out of the hat. I had no idea, but he pulled it out of the hat. Whether it was something that was really planned or not, I don't know. I wasn't overly bothered. I just wanted to do the job, and I was delighted to come down. So, you know, within no time at all, I'd driven down, and the next day was announced as the manager, which was Again, I realise and I can remember there was definitely people going, I know he's done well there, but I'm not sure whether he's ready for this type of job, you know. But as I've said, I was thoroughly at the time ready for that type of a challenge. I went straight to day one and got stuck into it, you know. So there was people to move on, there was people to bring in. I never really had any money as such, you know. I wasn't really given a pot of gold to go out with. And most of my signings sort of raised people's eyebrows. I think they're going, "What? Where's he from?" I remember people like Fitzpatrick from Stockport, and Jimmy Willis from Darlington. Michael Trotter, who he wasn't even a regular at Darlington, brought him down. I there was something about building a dressing room together with people that milked into each other, and that's what I based the initial period on trying to bring in the type of person who I knew would have a real goal, you know, and were good fun and a good laugh. I mean, Fitzpatrick was one of the funniest lads ever. I remember one day he came in to me. We'd been in the canteen and he just bought a little house down there. He said, "Any chance of me having some of the furniture out the canteen?" I mean, there were just canteen chairs and a canteen table. I went, "Bitsy, if you need that in your house, you take that home, son. There's a table and four chairs." You know, I mean, and he did. Yeah, of course he did. Yeah, those sort of things. We brought everything back down to earth. Not that it wasn't down to earth before. The one thing I would do when I went into a club, especially like Leicester, it was my way. It wasn't a criticism of the way before. I wasn't interested in how it was done before. This was how I wanted to do it. And saying what I'm saying, I'm not criticizing people before me. This was how I wanted to do it. Alan Evans and I brought John Gregory. John rang me. John had had a really tough time at Portsmouth and was really a bit down in the dumps and said, "Look, I need another opportunity." I said, "Well, come and work for me." He said, "Yeah, but I want to be a manager, Brian." I said, "John, if the time ever comes in your life where you want to be a manager, then I will allow that to happen for you. Let me tell you, because I'm of exactly the same mind. You know, if people want to do things, I've never stopped anyone doing what they wanted in their life." So John came to me and Alan, Stevie Hunt to start with. Stevie was a good lad. And we just joined in everything we could. At the time, I was still fit enough to just run a little bit. Alan and John were still incredibly fit. We did everything. We did the pre-season with the players. We made sure we did a lot of hard work, a lot of organisation. Played with three centre-backs. The minute I said three centre-backs, I remember, again, there was this sort of noise around the place going, "Oh, we're going to be defensive, aren't we? We're not going to be exciting." But I'd done that for 2 years at Darlington, scored more goals than any other team in that league. And it worked. If you had the right, if you could match a player into a system. So I was already into the point, like I've said, of building a team and not a team of individuals. Mm-hmm. And I've always worked at that because I look at Ron Saunders' teams. Ron Saunders built four teams in five different years at Aston Villa and took them from the second division to the first division to the league champions to the European Cup, even though Tony Barton won that. It was the Ron Saunders team. Yeah. He built a team and he had a system that every individual worked in that role perfectly. So, at that period, I mean, the modern game now, that's almost impossible to do. You can't just have a team. You've got to have real talented individuals today. But in that period, in the 90s, a team spirit, a team organisation, a functional team, an organised team could win things. And that's what I tried to put together there.
And how much of a sort of, when you walk through the door and you sort of realise, oh my God, you know, it was in a bit of a mess, Leicester, wasn't it? And you installed, I'm quoting here, he introduced a new, this is off the Leicester City website, I'm not just making this up.
Yeah.
He introduced a new set of rules at the training ground, emphasising the importance of punctuality, the ability of wearing of flip-flops, and the importance of wearing the correct attire and of being clean-shaven on match days.
That's right.
And you also got rid of the pool table. I bet you were popular.
probably. But at the same time, everything I did was followed. I never fined anyone. I fined people £5. That was the maximum I fined a football player at Leicester City and at Aston Villa and prior and after that again. I felt fines were there just to somehow have a bit of a laugh and a joke, but at the same time, just to make sure that, you know, people. So we would have, say, flip-flops. You know, generally speaking, in the dressing room, Alan Evans and John Gregory, we'd have a little walk around when we finished training, and somebody would be there without the flip-flops because they'd been hidden by one of the players, you know, so you just to get a £5. And they created that little atmosphere in the dressing room where everybody had a little bit of a laugh and a joke. And every penny that we made went to a hospital charity at the end of the year. So I just tried to create an atmosphere inside the dressing room, which that was fun. That the players, knowing players as they were, they would try and catch their mates out and stuff like that. They'd make sure they put the wrong shirt on or whatever, you know, that they'd swap the training shirt just before and somebody would walk in. It's a big setup saying, somebody's got my shirt on. And then Alan and John had sipped through them and so-and-so has got the wrong shirt. But he didn't know. He just picked his shirt, but it had been moved around by one of the players. We created an atmosphere where they just really got on with each other, teased each other, pushed each other, tested each other. Made each other think about things, so they were always aware of what was going on in the dressing room. And really, that was just how one of the things that ended up as being part of the mechanics of putting a team spirit together. There was many other things, like I said, Alan and John and myself trying to do as much of the training as we could. There was not splitting the group. I always remember as a young footballer, you know, when players used to get called out of the group and stuck in the reserve team from the first team, I said, oh, that's horrible. You know, that's really embarrassing. So yeah. I never split anyone away. Everybody trained together. Everybody worked together. Obviously, there were times that I did the pattern and the shape of the team, so I needed the team out there. But everybody looked at it. Everybody watched it. Everybody was, you know, as part of it as they could be. And it was a period where we built a spirit that we liked, that we believed in. And when you look at people like Gary Coatsworth, Fitzpatrick, Michael Trotter, all these lads who come in and did a job for us, you know, it's like pulling them out of a lucky bag, isn't it, really? You know, where did they come from? You know, it's like, wow, how's he play so well for us? Because he knew how the team played and he settled into a system that suited him. And the players around him all gelled together because of that. Now, today you can't do that. I accept that. It is all about talent and everything. But we created a great spirit and were competitive in that first season.
But I think you also, like you say, that team spirit, that togetherness, it's almost like a 12th man. You know, they say that about the fans. But, you know, looking at the Leicester team that won the Premier League.
Yeah, brilliant.
There was, you know, Mark O'Brien from Villa on a free. Yeah. Christian Fuchs came in on a free. I mean, there was a lot of players that had not made it elsewhere. Yeah, and it was just that band of brothers, they used to call it, didn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Team. Yeah, it, again, I think, you know, that was very prevalent in that period. Not, again, with the greatest respect, you know, most people would have thought one of the big teams might have caught them at the end and got over, but they never did, and that was brilliant. But again, I just think even these years on, it's more difficult to do that. You can have a team spirit. I mean, I think West Ham last year had a great team spirit, which has kept them in a great position. I think to be uber successful and to win things, I'm not sure that is an overriding factor to help you do that. It can help you be competitive. It can help you be in there and part of it. And outside of the Premier League, I still think that's massively important. It's massively important to have a good team spirit in the Premier League. But I think having talent is the way you win things at that level. Whereas throughout the other leagues, it's still about building a team, make sure that everybody's getting on with each other, be organised, be disciplined, be aware of what the each person can do, what their jobs are. But that was the way I was brought up with Ron Saunders. We were never the greatest team, never the greatest set of individuals, but my God, he knew how to build a team and team spirit and how people worked off each other. And that's really where I tried to do my business with as well.
And you turned it around, and I mean, a few years ago, you did a thing for me, my favorite things, and it was five questions, and you had to pick your favorite.
Yeah.
You still wouldn't pick a favorite player. You said it was like picking your favorite child. But I said on that there that you will be known and loved at Leicester as like almost like the playoff manager, if you like.
Yeah.
And you got us, so close with Blackburn. I mean, Davy Speedy dived, didn't he?
Of course he did.
Yeah.
But Speedy. I mean, to be honest, it was definitely the most controversial signing I've made in my life. I mean, Speedo was... but you know what? I remember thinking I'd rather have him in my team than against me.
Yeah.
I tried to choose games. I mean, he almost single-handedly made it as difficult as he possibly could to have the spirit in the dressing room, because him and Walsh used to fall out for fun. You know what I mean? Oh, my word. It was,
I can imagine.
Yeah. If whatever rules you put into a little five-a-side game, six-a-side game, Speedy would bend the rules. You know what I mean? He wouldn't comply. You know what I mean? He was always awkward. But that awkwardness was what made him what he was, you know? And I remember... Again, my vivid memory of Speedo would be, you know, being sent off against Tranmere in the semi-final. And that actually was the best thing that happened to me. And I know he gets upset with me when I say that, but because I didn't really want to play him in the final. I mean, I thought if we get the final, he's going to get sent off at Wembley. I can't. But he actually won that game by winding. I mean, Eric Nixon must have rang 40 yards out his goal to hit them, I think, wouldn't he, really? But Speedo was like that. But he had a wonderful competitive way. He was very difficult to deal with. I love Speedo to bits. But match days, I think, oh, what's going to happen today? Because I know he's going to wind somebody up or say something or do something. But it was a gamble that genuinely paid off for us.
Yes.
But he was... When you look back and say, is anybody that wasn't in your sort of the type of thing you wanted to do as a manager? I think Speedo sticks out very much at the top, because it was a risk. It was a difficult one to make the decision on. But I just thought to myself, every now and again, you need somebody who might just, in a different way, win a football match for you. And he was that type of player who could do that. So it was a gamble, but yeah, I yeah, it was great to get the 3 points.
Did he have? Because these are the rumours, whether they are true or not. That when you signed him, he said, "Yes, but if we go up, you're not going to sack me."
No, I don't think so.
No, I get that must be one of those sort of rumours that goes around and builds up over the years.
I think if he'd said that to me, I don't think I'd have signed him. I think if anybody had said anything outrageous like that, I don't think I'd have signed them. I mean, I took on one or two difficult people in my life, but I always was, you know, straightforward with them as I could be. You know, at the end of the day, there has to be a chief, and there has to be a group of people who understand that the chief is the chief, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And sometimes as a chief, you have to be big enough to walk in and say it was my fault, you know. But if you are that leader, you still have to be big enough some days to say that's my fault, you know, instead of making other excuses with other people or anything else. So I think, if I'm honest, I was probably one of my strengths. You know, I was probably one of the the hardest person I treated was myself. Really, I was as critical of myself as anybody. Yeah, you hear all sorts of things out of, you know, football, the football rumour mill. But there was nothing like that with Speedo, or nothing at all.
And how hard was it to overcome? Because I say you got to Wembley, we had a great day out, the city was all blue and white everywhere, and we lost in the way that we lost. Did that go into next season a case of, right, we're going to get it right this season? How did you pick the team up from that?
Well, again, I can't remember exactly when the decisions were made, but I'm sure they were made before the final itself. That whatever happened, now whether this was towards the end of the season, thinking that we're going to get into the playoffs or not, I can't remember. But I know for a fact we had made sure that everybody knew that we would be back training on July 1st for the next season, come what may. no matter what. So, you know, if we were to have 6 or 7 weeks holiday or 4 weeks holiday, there was no difference. No one was allowed to book a holiday in July because you got to the end, because you worked till the end of May. So you only got four weeks off while the other people. And that was a definite, that was said. I can't remember. I don't think it was put in writing or anything like that, but that was cast in stone in those 3 years. Mm. And leading, when that was said after the first one, when we'd lost the game, by the time I'd got home, I was already thinking about what, you know, I mean, or even before, I was thinking about what we were going to do pre-season. What do, everybody knew the date we were coming back, what type of player we might get interested in or whatever had to be, you know, on the result itself. But that was exactly the same for the 3 years. You know, it was cast in stone that nobody was having an extra 2 weeks holiday or anything. You know, if it was 4 weeks, it's 4 weeks. If we finished, if we got to the end of the season, we weren't in the playoffs, it was July the 1st, we come back, or whatever relevant date it was. You know, but there was no, oh, right, lads, you can have an extra cup. Because I think, I remember looking back over the, when we got to the playoffs, and I remember seeing things about, you know, oh, so-and-so, they've given so many players so many extra days because they played longer. And I was thinking, well, the longer they're away from it, the less your preparation is. And at that level, we were in the championship. You know, we didn't have international footballers as such. So, you know, they weren't getting sent off to play extra games here, there, or anywhere, or anything like that. So my mentality was, irrespective of what the result was in a playoff situation, the date for pre-season was set in stone and everybody would be there. And that was, and for, we were just totally focused on that each of the 3 years, you know, each of it, it was right. Okay. Win or lose, we are back on this date. If we'd won when we did win the last one, it wasn't the case, all right, lads, you can have an extra week off now or anything like that. You know, for winning, it was, you're back that date. The date you're back. We're not messing around. You've got enough time to have rest. Enjoy your rest. Take your rest in. But we were very focused on making sure everybody knew that, you know. So,
And the semi-final before we played Blackburn, we had Cambridge.
Yeah.
And you said obviously on that favourite thing that I think it was 5-0, wasn't it? We beat Cambridge, you said that was probably your favourite game at Leicester City.
I think that without a doubt. I mean, it was the most incredible performance.
Yes,
we were out. The fans were incredible. The team were outstanding. Little Tommy Wright was unbelievable. It was a great game. It's my favourite game. It's, you know, as a football manager, it is high up there in my top three games of all time, because it was just a. Remember. Earlier that season, Cambridge beat us 5-1 at Cambridge, and I got dog's abuse. I remember getting on the bus, and afterwards we were hopeless, and I got absolutely hammered by people. Oh, my word. And we'd had a decent start to the season, but, you know, when you get beat 5-1 against, you know, a team like Cambridge, who everybody thought was not going, they were an incompetitive team, in all fairness.
They were,
But, oh, God, I got hammered. And for to really turn that around by the end of the season, but the game itself, the night itself, the performance itself, the atmosphere, it still sticks with me now. I still feel that was definitely one of my most enjoyable nights ever as a football manager. It was a wonderful performance by the team, and I thought it was great. I still love that particular match. Yeah.
And I know, and I've been thinking all night how I'm going to introduce this into the conversation. Yeah. I know you hate talking about it, and you probably know what's going to be coming up. But the following season, we got back to Wembley, and I lived at the time with my then fiancé in Blackburn, as it happened, and I travelled all the way down to Leicester because it was Central TV were covering it because Leicester were in the final. And sit down and watch us go 3-0 down to Swindon. I mean, I know we lost the game. I know you hate talking about it. You said it many times. But I still love the spirit and the way we fought back in that game. And again, another dodgy penalty. And yeah. I think that was the journey back from Leicester to Blackburn, which was about 3.5 hours. I don't think I spoke to my fiancée once. The longest time. She tried to, and I just wasn't. She was driving. Yeah. I was just an emotional wreck. But what a game. I know you say it didn't go for us, but I absolutely loved that game.
I think loads of people have, and it would still crop up on TV if they were looking at playoff finals that were that had a bit of everything. That probably would be it. I think the momentum we got back into the game would have made everybody think there's only one winner here. You know, when we got back to 3-3, the difference is that there is generally always a goal that can change that game when you come back like that. And we just got a little bit carried away with the euphoria of it and were caught out. It was a very difficult one to take. I mean, you know, the rumours before the game that Hoddle was going to leave and go to Chelsea were true. He was unbelievable on the day. I mean, he was outrageous. I mean, he played incredibly well. It was a really tough one. We either beat them twice or drew one. I don't think we lost to them in the league that season. I should have checked that before, but my mind is telling me that we'd actually beaten them or we'd drawn at their place and won it. So we hadn't lost to them. We were probably just about the favourites for the game, I guess, before it. It was a real tough one to take. I still can remember Stevie Thompson was in bits after that game. I remember that, giving him a big hug. It was so hard to take. I mean, but again, for us to switch straight into next season mode after the game, I thought that was brilliant, you know. So there was always that as well. It was like, I wouldn't be surprised if I said it in the dressing room, right, July the 1st, see you next season, we're going for it again, sort of thing. You know, I mean, I could imagine that would genuinely have come out of my mouth. And I would imagine one or two would have been thinking, for God's sake, just disappear, will you? Shut up. But I'm going to, but I had to say it, you know, it had to be said.
Yeah. Well, it is. They say that, you know, getting back on the bike if you fall off, I suppose. Yeah, cool. But I mean, half time, I think we were just 1-0 down at half time, and we must have still been in it. So you got your game plan, and then we come out, and within 10 minutes, we're 3-0 down. Did you think at that point we could get back in it?
Can I honestly say I don't remember?
It's a while ago now.
It was one of them games. We always felt we could score against them. That was the thing, you know. I think that was it. And once we got the first goal, it was a case of, right, come on, just roll your sleeves up and let's go, sort of thing. And that was we had that in us throughout those 3 years. We had that in us. You know, we did lose some games. And every now and again, we had a game that we were really poor in. But then without that as well, there was always lots of games that we were pretty unlucky in. So we were a decent side. We were a good bunch of people. And I think the mentality genuinely from myself would have been, look, well, just keep going for it now, 3-0. The fact I'd like to think that, well, I don't think I could get a message on a 3-3. I don't think that would have made any difference at all. But we were just so pumped up then. That it was a massive disappointment to lose the game the way we did. But again, as I've said, you use that as part of your build up for and test people and what are we made of, and thinking as a manager, is there any little tweak I can make to the team that make us a little bit different for next season? We went to Wembley first time round and I think everybody looked upon it as being a day out, and not that we did. But in fairness, you know, we'd been fourth off bottom the season before. We finished fourth off top. We were very competitive. We'd come on a long way. We're playing Blackburn, who had the money in football at that time. And if we'd won the game, everybody would have been absolutely outrageously surprised. But it was hard to be disappointed after you lost. It was almost we were proud of what we'd done, I think, more than anything else. And that wasn't to say we weren't going into the game thinking we couldn't win, because we did go into the game thinking we could win. But it was very easy to go, right, lads, you've been brilliant, fantastic. See you on July 1st, simple as that. And then we'd go again, sort of thing, you know. So, but the Swindon one, well, that was a big that was a massive test of character, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To lose that game, irrespective of what you were thinking through the game, irrespective of 3-3, how have we got back to 3-3? We got back to 3-3 because we're a good team and we want to do well. But we've lost again. So let's come back again. And sitting on that bus for the third time going to Wembley, I mean, John Allen and myself used to just giggle at each other. Used to go, are we going back here again? what are we doing? It was like, you know, this can't be real, sort of thing. You know,
one of the players that was in your team for that, and I know you absolutely liked him as a player, and I've read his autobiography, and he speaks so highly of you, and that's Julian Joachim.
Yeah, JJ was brilliant. Yeah. I love the little fella.
I think you picked his goal against Portsmouth in the semi-final leading up to that game as your favourite goal at Leicester.
Yeah, goal. And he scored one at Barnsley as well, which was unbelievable. The outside foot. But the Portsmouth goal was bordering on brilliant. Little JJ was a great lad. Had something about him, great edge, strong as an ox, good little finisher. Yeah, he was absolutely one of the best that we had. You know what I mean? It was great to see a young lad come through like that. I don't know whether I've said this to you, and I've said this to a lot of Leicester people over the years. If I'd lost that last final, I think the board would have sacked me because of the team I picked, to be honest.
Steve Walsh up front, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, when I look at the team I picked, I remember when Colin Gibson, I still speak to Gibbo today, and Gibbo always says to me, how did you pick me to play in that game in the final? I said, he said, because he'd hardly played. I said, do you know, I genuinely, it was one of those games where I went in thinking we are the underdogs here. Mm. You know, Derby had got some really talented young players. They were right at the top of their game. And we had to really, in my opinion, and I just felt if we'd gone out there and tried to play like we had against Swindon, we were going to get beaten. Mm. So I picked a team that I thought might frighten them. Now, that's one hell of a brave decision. And I still say to this day, if I'd lost that game, lots of people, including the board, would have looked at it and gone, how has he picked that team? Why has he picked that team? Simple answer, I wanted to win the game. I didn't believe if I'd picked the sort of team that they might have expected us to pick, they would have gone, we can win this and we will win this. So it was a massive gamble on my behalf. Thankfully, it came off. But again, I just know when I look back at it, and I know people would have thought afterwards if I'd lost, they'd gone, well, he's lost the plot. He's gone. He's the big centre forwards.
It's like when you bring, you know, you make a substitution and within two or three minutes you score a goal. You know, suddenly you're the best tactical genius ever, you know. Yeah. But, I mean, looking down that team, I've got to say, I mean, we won it 2-1. Yes. It became the silence of the lambs. I think that you did it over Derby made it even more special. Again, before we get on to sort of a couple of the players, the atmosphere, I mean, it was just being totally different on the coach coming back. And then when you got back to Leicester,
I loved it. I mean, we had it was incredible. It was a brilliant feeling. It was the end of three unbelievably hard years where we pushed ourselves to the limit. John Allen and myself were exactly the same. You know, we worked our socks off. The players were responsive. I can't remember ever having bad days with them. You know, everybody was really clued into what we wanted to do, what we were trying to do. Each particular season, there was a slight twist to the team to make it a little bit different or a little bit better. It was the end of a 3-year period where you look back and some of the lads who'd even left by then, but you knew everybody had made their contribution to a remarkable recovery from a club that had. You know, we'd not spent a lot of money. We've not spent a lot of money at all in terms of other people in the championship. We've not spent a lot of money. We'd recouped a few players. We changed a few things. I mean, I did some controversial things with Paul Kitson going and Phil G and Ormondroyd coming in, but I needed to change the team. Otherwise, I felt we wouldn't have got into the playoffs that year. Even though we had a good player in our ranks, I felt I needed to tweak the team. So lots of things that we tried to do all seemed to work for us. And it was after that win, it was a hugely satisfying sigh of relief that came through my body more than anything else. Like, wow, we've actually done it. You know, if we'd failed again, I think my time might have finished there. And then primarily because of the team I picked.
Yes,
but we had some wonderful people, all worked. I mean, so many people did so many great things for us, players who'd left, players who'd stayed. It was the end of an incredible effort on the club's behalf, really.
And talking about the team, and you mentioned his name earlier, and I've got to say it again, Steve Walsh. I mean, you know, we all know Walshy. Again, he's been on the channel a few times. And, I mean... Putting him, what a masterstroke, like you say, one of those like playing as a centre forward. But you know, and I think everybody's favourite pictures is him running after him, having scored that second goal, of him just turning and running.
Yeah.
I mean, was he difficult to manage?
No, Walsh was a lovely person. He was a fireball. I mean, the thing is, he had a very short fuse. And whenever we played Wolves, I was always worried about him because I knew him and Steve Ball would kick off. That was an absolute certainty. Walsh's biggest problem was, like, you know, he had this very short fuse that if somebody wound and, it, and people would often try and wind him up in games, you know, and we'd be on the sideline just trying to urge him to calm himself down a bit. But he'd been badly injured. He came back. I mean, his entire career, when you played small-sided games on the training ground, he'd always be centre forward. He'd never play centre half. He'd never sit back in five-a-side games. He'd always be up front. He was one of them players who, you know, we had to manage right. I mean, he would often come in my room on a Friday and say, oh, my groin's sore or this, and I'd say, you'll be all right. Well, I'll see you tomorrow. We'll not pick the team today, Walsh. We'll pick it tomorrow, sort of thing. So you just knew once you got the smell of the match, he was going to be all right again, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So he had his moments where he was, you know, I think he was worried about, he thought about games, he thought about people, he was quite an intense character, which people would either agree with or disagree with. But when you work with them closely like that, he was one of the players that would knock on my door quite regular and say, oh, this is sore and that's sore. And I'd just say to him, well, I tell you what, you wait till tomorrow. At 1 o'clock, we'll have a chat in the dressing room before the game. But I knew he'd play. I knew he would play, sort of thing. So, you know, just handling and man management with people like that. Ormondroyd was the same. Big Sticks used to knock on my door on a Friday, you know, and he'd be frightened. He used to think when we played Jerry Taggart, I remember he'd always say to me, oh, he's the strongest man in the world. I can't play against him, Gaffer. I'd say, you are. I'll stick you on the left wing so you play out there today. With just little things, little niches that little man management things all the times with players. You know, the number time. Like I've always said this, when you're a football manager and you make a decision and all the fans are going, why has he done this and why has he done that? Generally speaking, there's been a conversation through the week that's influenced the manager on doing something a little bit different. He knows more than anybody else about what's going on. He knows individuals because they need to speak to him. And I, over the years, in my 900 and odd games as a manager at all those different levels, I can remember picking teams and saying to people, we'll do this today or we'll do that today, which... You know, sometimes the fans will go, what's going on here? Why is he doing that? Which you can't tell them because it's a personal thing. That player's a little bit worried about this or he's a little bit concerned about that or this is going on in his life, that's going on in his life. And you make managerial decisions on the back of all those things. So,
but, of course, you have got 40,000 managers in the ground every week.
Absolutely, yeah, but that's fine. And, you know, that's part and parcel of the business and that's part and parcel of what makes the great game great. Mm-hmm. But there are times when, like I say, you can't divulge some of the things that are told to you and it's hard to put it across. So all of those things go into management. And Walshy was very I don't think many people would have thought Walshy would have knocked on my door virtually every Friday, but he did. You know, he did. He was quite concerned about this and he was worried about that. And but that was him on a Friday. That was normal Walshy. But you'd know on a Saturday, you just say, right, I need you to do this and I need to, yeah, okay, Gaffer, I'm off. I'm playing. That's it. I'm okay. I'm going to be fine. Either that or he just fancied a little rest on a Friday.
You need to go out and have a drink. That's what he was. But I gotta say, we got promoted. To me, that was when Leicester started to get turned around. And a lot of people do say that, you know. And yes, we've had our ups and downs after that. You know, Mr. Taylor's manager wasn't our most successful. Mr. O'Neill was. But did you ever see us winning the Premier League?
Wow. Well, I think that's a bit of a controversial question for me to answer, but I think like everyone else, I mean, it was a blessing for the game. Brilliant. I'm not sure how or whether it'll be seen again. You know, you're looking at your Liverpool, Man City's, Chelsea's, Man United, and they, as I've said, are now in a position where, you know, they look to secure the best players. And when people produce a good player or a potentially great player, generally speaking, those clubs come along and sort of sneak them off you type of thing. So,
yes.
It was an incredible achievement. That's all I can say. It was an incredible achievement.
Yes.
I watched Leicester play a few times that season and even before the year they went up again with Drinkwater and people like that playing in the midfield for them. I remember them thinking, wow, that's a good team. That's a decent team. You know, so it was a marvellous achievement. Did I ever think, I think the way the game's changed, you'd probably think, well, there are only four or five teams that now are potentially big enough and now buy what they need to buy. To be there. So, but I think it was great that Leicester did it. I was genuinely delighted. And it's great because if you're part of the history of a club, whatever period you're there, if you're part of that club's history, to see them doing well is fantastic. There's not, you know, wherever I've been and whatever I've done in football, I still look at those teams' results. I still, you know, as soon as Saturday's over, as soon as the games are over, you know, I'm trolling through my phone, sort of trying to see how Tranmere have got on, or how Darlington have got on, how Leicester have got on.
I'm the same. I mean, I've moved around the country. I'm down on the south coast now, but you know, I look to see how, because I lived in Burnley for 20 odd years, so I kind of follow them a little bit. I'm in Blackpool, and you just keep an eye on them, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
But hopefully, it's given other teams sort of hope that they can live the dream. Because we certainly did, and I never thought I would see it in my lifetime. So, if you ever want to see a grown man cry, that was it. I remember I used to do that season because we did so well. I used to do quite a bit with Talk Sport, and I don't know how I got away with what I did on that night when they rang me and said, "Will you come on?" Because I was absolutely I'd had a few bevies. Let's just say that. And B, I was absolutely in tears wrecked. But great times. But Brian, and I think I say this on behalf of all Leicester fans, for what you did at Leicester, thank you so very, very much.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was a great period in my life and I loved it to bits, you know. So thank you very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank you so much for giving up your time and coming on this morning. Really, I know you're a busy man, so I really do appreciate it, because I say, no, it's your personal time. Please give all my best to yourself and your family. And good luck for the season.
All right. See you around. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks to Brian there for coming on. What a nice guy. What a nice guy. Like I say, for me, he was the manager that started the revolution. You know, yes, he went. We had Mark McGee. Yeah, he went to Wolves, who he's sort of the bigger club. How did that work out, Mark? Martin O'Neill. Peter Taylor obviously was a little bit being polite, but that's how it goes. But no, great times under Brian Little, and I do appreciate him giving up his time and coming in. We will see you soon. Thank you very much for tuning in and watching us on YouTube. Like I said, please subscribe to the channel if you haven't, and give a like to the video as well. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, thank you for lending me your ears. And I will see you soon. Take care, stay safe, and don't do anything I wouldn't enjoy.
Thanks for watching Leicester Till I Die. This is Chris saying goodbye, and see you next time.
Watching these videos are tremendous. You better like them too, or I'll be back.
Cool, I'm out of here. Ooh, that's a wrap.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates around. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping. And you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network.
TalkSport. Powered by fans.